just greet yourself. And this is, of course, a misinterpretation of that greeting, but it could serve as an explanation for that I come from a very self-sufficient cultural background, and this is why I'm talking on my own conference. And I have to.
But at least you're not sharing it.
I'm not sharing my own talk. So, yes, so Enrique gave an introduction into our joint work on shape dynamics. And I want to point out that the Erlang group has done something very similar in the loop quantization framework. And there will be a talk by Alexander Stottmeister on Saturday about that. So what I want to talk about here is this thing that that we have that Enrique was pointing to at the end, that we ultimately were motivated by a quantum theory, and we would naively want a gauge fixed Hamiltonian for the quantum theory, BST gauge fixed Hamiltonian, and that leads in a very natural way to having this doubly general relativity. So this is work that is based on two drafts that are still not out, but that are going to appear soon. And to start out with what Julian said in his colloquium yesterday, he laid out two Machian principles. So one was he wanted relativity of local clocks. He wanted to be able to measure time locally with your wristband watch. And he motivated that to have what he calls the local square root, so and model that as local time reparametrization invariance, which gives you the local Hamilton constraints in his formalism, in his way of thinking about relativity. On the other hand, he also motivated strongly that relativity of spatial rods should be, and that would be modeled as local spatial conformal invariance, so this would give local spatial conformal constraints. But as we saw in Flavio's talk, and as it's, I think, widely known, and also Ed Anderson has done extensive work on it, these are generally second-class systems. If you have conformal transformations and local Hamilton constraints, this form generally a second-class system. So second-class constraints cannot be viewed as generators of gauge transformations when they're second class. You can only view half of them. If one half of them is first class, you can view that as a symmetry, but not the whole package. And in particular, if you choose your second class constraints function unwisely, you may never find the first one half that is inherently first class. You have to choose this. You can show that you can locally always find them, but you may have to rewrite your constraints in a particular way. And what I want to point out in this talk is the possibility, I think this is the laser pointer, yeah, that on the BRS extended phase space, you can still not impose both as symmetries in this sense, but you can at least construct a Hamiltonian that is invariant under both a gauge fixed Hamiltonian that is invariant under two BRS transformations, one encoding the symmetry of shape dynamics and one encoding the symmetry of ADM, the time refoliation symmetry. So as a kid, I was always greedy. I needed a cookie for each hand. So I want both. So I go with that option. So the heuristic for this is something the first thing what motivated when Julian gave a colloquium about 2.5 years ago.
Three and a half.
Three and a half years. It was I had just started here. It was the first or second week that I was at Perimeter when he gave that colloquium. And before that, I had hoped that somehow we could have a conformal version of gravity, for the very simple reason, because I came from a loop. I had previously done a little bit of work on loop quantum gravity, and I thought, well, we know so nicely how to implement the spatial diffeomorphisms in this framework. If we had another spatially geometric transformation that would kill all these gauge degrees of freedom that should be killed by the Hamilton constraints, which are so hard to quantize, then we would have won a lot. And this is why I was really excited when Julian gave a talk and he said, I have a first principles derivation of GR and CMC gauge. This was the punchline, for me, the punchline of that talk. And so I was motivated by the quantum theory, but I will use a slightly different motivation now. So if you look at a Hamiltonian, at a phase space passing degree, so I have a dq dp that should be viewed as canonically conjugate. And I have some constraints chi, and I have some gauge fixing conditions sigma, and then I would write down the Fadeev Popov determinant. And in the case where the on-shell Hamiltonian, like in a general covariance theory, where the on-shell Hamiltonian vanishes, you just have the symplectic potential up there. And then if you do the De Witt Fadeev Popov construction, there are some differences that I will allude to later, because this works only for very special classes of constraints and gauge fixing functions where you can do the De Witt Fadeev Popov thing to get such a representation for that. But essentially, what you get is that you have a BAS generator and a gauge fixing fermion in the exponential and the symplectic potential, and you integrate over the Qs and Ps and the ghost and ghost momenta. So my wish list for quantum theory would be...
you are talking about something associated with the Hamiltonian constraint and something associated with the CMC thing.
Yes.
There's also, of course, the three different orbits.
Yes, I will come.
Is that playing second fiddle here? And if so, why?
No, it's not playing second fiddle, and it will actually... I will actually have to modify what I mean with the shape dynamics constraint surface to incorporate the gauge fixing for the spatial diffeomorphisms, and I will come to that later in the talk. So there will be a technical reason why it has to be split up this way, but let's not talk about it in the talk. Let's talk about that in the discussions afterwards.
Okay. So. What do you mean by S1 and S2?
I will come to that in a second. I wasn't there yet. So my wish list for the quantum theory, because I was motivated by Julian, was that I could implement somehow both Machian invariances. Something where omega is a BAS generator, a BAS transformation that is ADM, essentially. Or not is essentially ADM, that is ADM. And psi is a BAS generator that implements the symmetries that Julian has been motivating yesterday. So, and I would like to have locality because we know much better how to deal with local field theories than with non-local. Personally, or at least if you're traditional, you want local kind of field theories. And then what we would like, what we don't have yet, but what we would strongly like is to have a large part of these symmetries, a large part of these BAS transformations realized linearly, because then we could immediately conclude that they're implemented as symmetries of the quantum effective action, not just of the bare action. And the intuitive interpretation of this is on my wish list here, but this was already nicely presented yesterday in the two talks by Julian, who gave the intuitive interpretation, and Flavio, who gave some mathematical background on that. So let me reuse this slide that we have used that extensively in talks recently. This is what Enrique showed. We have two first-class constraint surfaces that gauge fix one another. And this is essentially why we are able to use either, because physics happens only on this purple line. This is where the part of phase space where each observable is uniquely determined by its dependence on this intersection. So if you do a reduced phase space quantization, you would just quantize that, the purple line. If you do Dirac quantization, you pull this thing apart. You look at the entire constraint surface, and you impose that it commutes with that. But the important thing here is that we have two first class surfaces that gauge fix one another, and I will in a second give you a quick and dirty introduction to BRST, and just for the purpose to catch those people up who have seen Fadeev Popov but not the Hamiltonian formulation space. Yes?
That's one thing. I see there is a cosmological constant on the left hand side. Is it crucial they have cosmological constant?
No, not in this. At this point, it is not crucial to have a cosmological constant. It turns out that with the cosmological constant, you have a larger part of phase space where the entire construction works, because the York procedure works in a larger part of phase space than with the cosmological constant and without. It's very similar to having some. No, let's not talk about it. So the one thing that I want to skip over, but that will be important for Alexander Stoppmeister's talk, is that there is a relation of observables. And if there are questions at the end, I will come back to that. So essentially, what I said here in words, that observables live essentially on this purple intersection, that can be spelled out in more detail. And let me go straightforwardly to the Hamiltonian BRST formalism. And for a quick and dirty introduction, it's okay to start out with abelian constraints. So I have abelian constraints all constraints Poisson commute, strongly Poisson commute with one another. And then you adjoin to each constraint a ghost. So this is denoted by the zeta alpha here. And the ghost momentum, where did I write it? I denote it as a capital P, always. And the alpha refers to this index that the constraints have. But then I just postulate this form of the BRST generator right now. And then I claim, and then you can immediately check that if those are abelian, and the ghost and ghost momenta have anti-commuting statistics now. If you have bosonic constraints, you have fermionic. Or if you have fermionic constraints, if you have a supersymmetry, for example, then you would have bosonic ghosts. They just have always the opposite statistics. This means that the BRST generator is odd. This means the Poisson bracket is even in it. So this condition here is a non-trivial condition that the BRST generator commutes with itself. But in this representation, you can check it by explicit calculation. But this means, this identity together with the Jacobi identity means that you can define a differential, this S here, by just taking Poisson brackets with omega. And differential with that, I mean that I have that twice the application of this vanishes on any phase space function. And that is important because now I have a graded differential algebra. I have the ghost number. Ghost count is ghost number plus one, and ghost momenta count is ghost number minus one as a grading. And I have a differential derivation that S squared is equal to zero. And then the usual story of BRST is that observables are the that this graded differential algebra mathematically is a resolution of the observer algebra. In other words, the observers are the cohomology of S at ghost number zero. And for a physicist, this is very easy to understand. If I have abelian constraints, I have a sufficient number of strong observables. So each observable has a representative, at least has one representative that is a strong observable for abelian constraints. And then I see, if I take this representative, that automatically commutes with omega just by the abelian condition. So okay, so we put a check mark on that we have for each observable, we have one representative. But now we can also do that for weak observables, because a weak observable is this strong observable plus an arbitrary linear combination of constraints where these sigma alphas here may be phase space dependent now. So this package here will be a weak observable. I can find any such weak observable by as the ghost free part of taking the Poisson bracket of my BAS generator with some gauge fixing fermion that is of this form plus higher order sin ghost that has ghost number minus one, and so but what I have to do then is I get, when I do this, I get a non-trivial extension. I get some more, I get terms that contain the ghosts. But this is the BAS extension that I get. But what you see now, because of this condition, because of omega omega equals zero, you see that that this F tilde is still strongly, when you write it with the BAS extension, you still have strong equations. This is the advantage of the BAS formalism over the Dirac formalism, because you can always use strong equations rather than weak equations. And then the gauge fixed Hamiltonian is just a non-shell Hamiltonian that is already constructed in such a way that it commutes with omega. You can show that you can always extend the Hamiltonian such that it commutes with omega. It's essentially the Hamiltonian is a prototype of an observable, and if you have a first class system, then you just do the BAS extension for that observable that strongly commutes. And then the gauge fixed Hamiltonian is the on-shell Hamiltonian with its BAS extension and the Poisson bracket of omega, I'm sorry. So this is the simple story. Now, I have done this all in the abelianized context, and locally in phase space, I can always abelianize constraints by just doing some transformation on the constraints. However, if I do this in a field theory, I introduce inherent non-localities in the field theory, because what I have written here neatly as a matrix is in general the inverse of some differential operator that has to act on that. But the observation now is, because I have an extended phase space, I can do a canonical transformation on this extended phase space to generate precisely this type of constraint that is local now. And where essentially the C has to exponentiate to M. Loosely speaking, there is some tricks to that. And then I can go to the non-abelian case, and I see I get an omega twiddle, a different BAS generator that has, as the zero order part, has precisely these constraints here, twiddle here, but it has higher order terms in omega in the ghost. And I can do exactly the same thing, because I had a canonical transformation, all the reasoning that I used up here, because I just used Poisson brackets, I can use down here. I just have to remember that I always.
In practice,
you never do this.
You never do that.
No, in practice, you use cohomological perturbation theory, and you don't do that. Now we come back to that point, because that will be important in a second. This was just to give an explanation that there is a Hamiltonian formalism that is behind for the proper which is not, which I suppose everybody is familiar with Fedor Popov, but not everybody is familiar with the Hamiltonian formulation. This is why I included this slide. So now comes precisely your point. When we do this, when we wanted to do the symmetry trading, we needed two first-class surfaces that gauge fix one another. When you do it, not this quick and dirty way of doing BRST, but when you do it with cohomological perturbation theory, then you see the reason why omega can be chosen nilpotent, why you have, why you can solve the nilpotency condition, is precisely because the constraints are first class. And now I have, but now I can do the same thing for my gauge fixing fermion. I can, because I have two first class surfaces that gauge fix one another, so I can choose my psi to be first class. So now if my system happens to have a non-shell Hamiltonian that commutes already with both omega and psi, in particular if I have a generally covariant system where the on-shell Hamiltonian vanishes, then my gauge fixed Hamiltonian, which will look like this, will be invariant under both transformations that are generated by both differentials. And this is what we just give this child a name, and we call it symmetry doubling. Before we called it symmetry trading, and now because in a sense, it may not be the most appropriate name, but it's in a sense you have two transformations that encode two different symmetries, and you impose them both. You can impose them both, and this means that we have an action because the symplectic potential just propagates the omega and psi. So up to this boundary term in time that comes from propagating them, you get a canonical action that is just invariant under this.
So you mean doubling in terms of number of degrees of freedom involved as opposed to doubling of details of the structure?
I mean doubling in a very naive way. I mean doubling in the sense that I have an action that is invariant under two different transformations that I can do, and that is of course. Yeah. So Lee.
Just to be clear, this takes place in the linking theory or the extended phase space.
This does not take place in the linking theory. It takes place on ADM phase space later. But in the BRS extension of this, so I join to each scalar constraint, so I join a scalar ghost, and to each and ghost momentum density, and to each diffeomorphism constraint, I join a vector ghost and momentum density.
So you have 5 degrees of freedom of ghost coordinates and 5 degrees of freedom of ghost momentum counting the spatial diffeomorphism.
Yes, but the story in this BRS extension is that only the ghost number zero is where observables are. So you don't so you enlarge phase space, but you don't enlarge the number of physical degrees of freedom or the number of observables. I mean, this is the same thing. This is the same thing. Why you don't calculate Feynman diagrams with external ghost lines? It's because they're not physical degrees of freedom.
That's a different question.
No, but it's exactly related to that. If you had if observables wouldn't be at ghost number zero, but it's something else, you would have to include those. And from this canonical logic, not from the David Fadeev Popov logic, from this canonical logic, you would have to do that.
Going back to that original picture you had where you extended the constraint surface on the five bundle, the first picture that you had. So how is the, maybe this is an unrelated question, but how is the Poisson bracket between omega and p realized in either one of those pictures?
Okay, the Poisson bracket between omega and p is realized in this sense that that this purple line here is a symplectic space. That is what is
collapse and basically that extend thing down
to that. Yes. So now we come to that, because that's an important point that I will come to in the next slide. This is different from what you know as entropy ST invariance. And let me give you just a very quick account for entropy ST in this canonical language. Not in this canonical language. In canonical language, if you just you throw away the primary constraint, you just have the secondary constraints to begin with. You go in A0 equals zero gauge there. So A0 is a Lagrange multiplier then. Then from the canonical perspective, you just double the constraints. You say, I have constraints chi that are there. Those are my secondary constraints. And I just double them. I give them number one and number two. But then I have immediately a reducibility condition, an identity that is automatically satisfied all over phase space. So now I have to, if I use the construction, the BIS construction for reducible constraints, I have to introduce second order growth, which are precisely introducing the Lagrange multipliers or the A0, again, back as physical degrees of freedom, because they now have to have opposite statistics to the ghosts, because they're ghosts of ghosts. And then this is in the abelian case, this is the BIS charge that I get. Now it turns out from a cohomological perturbation theory that this admits a bidegree expansion. And because of this bidegree expansion, I can split that up in two parts. One that is this omega 1 here, that has where the eta 1s and the p2s play a role. And the other one is, I think I just switched the minus sign in this notation. This is a mistake. Plus and minus should be reversed here. But you see the logic behind that. You can split that, and then you look at the algebras that is satisfied. In the anti-BST case, you have omega and omega bar, the BS generator and anti-BST generator. They commute with one another, and they commute with the Hamiltonian. We have the same thing here, but omega and omega bar vanish here, which is just because I had a redundant symmetry there. This is to your question. And in this case here, we get the Hamiltonian. So this looks like a Suzy algebra. You have two fermionic charges in a Poisson bracket is the Hamiltonian. So now, coming back to Ed's question about gauge fixing and diffeomorphisms also. In this formulation that I use here, I will also gauge fix the spatial diffeomorphisms now, not just the scalar constraints. So I gauge fix the scalar constraints with a fixed York term, so I fix all of them. I won't have one left over. And then I impose essentially spatial harmonic gauge, but I project onto the conformal part. I impose harmonic gauge, spatial harmonic gauge, only on the conformal metric, not on the entire metric. And then I get a first class system. If I just look at that, I can calculate Poisson brackets. The Q's commute with themselves, that is, because they're no derivatives. And that's just one of them. The FIs commute among themselves. And the Q's and the F's just reproduce an F. So that looks over each point like the dilatations, because this already has the physical, the Q's already have the physical interpretation of dilatation, because that's what they do to the metric. And the F's now form the same Lie algebra over each point as the special conformal transformations do with the dilatation. So this could be an intuitive way of understanding this. Sean Grip will take that intuitive interpretation to the extreme later. And so I use this system, this is first class, to gauge fix ADM. And this system is motivated. 10 minutes, okay. I think I'm in good shape for that. So what it turns out is that the gauge fixing operator is elliptic, and it has there is a region in phase space where it has a finite dimensional kernel, but it's always elliptic, so it's at least in a weak, in a physicist sense, it's always invertible.
Are you gauge fixing ADM or gauge fixing
with something to formalize ADM? No, I'm gauge fixing ADM with something that is...
ADM itself.
Yes, ADM itself. But with the gauge fixing that is motivated by this conformal symmetry. So now I have these two charges that they can be written down explicitly. So this is the ADM charge, and if you this already existed in literature before. This is our charge now, and you see it has ghost number minus one, like you expected, and it has and the lowest order parts at that. So now I can construct a gauge fixed gravity action. I write a symplectic potential in this formal way here, just C dot A and the momentum conjugate to CA for all canonical variables and the Poisson bracket of these two. So now you see that this gauge fixed action is invariant under two transformations. One is the usual ADM transformations that encode on shell at least a space-time diffeomorphism invariance. And the other one is something that is what is generated by this here, which is what is generated by shape dynamics. And you see, at least for the metric, you see that this reminds you immediately of conformal transformation of the gauge fixed. The pi a b's, the reason why this is long and more complicated, the first term looks like that. But the second term is now you have these FAs here, which contain a horrible mess of the metric, as I showed in the previous slide. The metrics popping up here, here, and here. And this is why this is a rather lengthy expression. I would have taken an entire line on this slide. But this symmetry is due to the first class property of this conformally motivated shape dynamics. So now I can look at this, and I see that this is neither when I look at the ghost free part of that. So what you would expect as the classical gauge fixed part of the Hamiltonian. You see that this is neither the frozen time Hamiltonian that I have h equals 0 essentially, nor do I have the CMC Hamiltonian here, but I have this Lagrange multiplier here. And this is where I lied on the first slide when I said I do Fadeev Popov, David Fadeev Popov. I should always include David because that's where I come from. I wrote my master's thesis in front of his office. you see that this is because when you do this trick, you go back and you have to these sigmas here that I write in here and that I write in this determinant are not the sigmas that I use to construct my psi. They are sigmas minus the Lagrange multiplier that I use to represent this delta function here. And then also, to get the symplectic potential correct, you have to add another term to that in the sigmas. This is the reason. There is no mystery. This is the reason why I get a different Hamiltonian at the end, a different gauge fixed Hamiltonian at the end. Yes?
Can you show qualitatively what the dependence on momentum variables is of this Hamiltonian
So you look at this. You have this is the scalar constraint of ADM smeared with this, and this is the diffeomorphism constraint of M smeared with these FAs that I defined two slides ago.
So what used to be the frozen Hamiltonian constraint?
Pardon me?
What used to be the frozen Hamiltonian constraint?
I don't understand the question.
What's happened to the Hamiltonian constraint?
The frozen one.
What's happened to the Hamiltonian constraint? What is it being replaced by here?
No, this is, if you look at this thing, the ghost-free part, you see that this is just what you get for the evolution for if you just look at the evolution generated on G and pi, this is, and not what happens to the BRS extension of the observers. This is the part that governs it. And that does something different. That generates a different flow than H equals zero, because the Poisson bracket, that is a thing, is not zero. This is all I'm saying.
Yeah. I don't understand why, I mean, the Poisson brackets aren't zero, but isn't that itself is still a constraint, right? It is just the scalar, the ordinary Hamiltonian constraint, yeah, smeared with a particular smearing, right?
Yes, there is a very particular sense in which I can make that statement precise, and it is precisely at the end, what after all the dust has settled, you would just evolve BRS observables with this Hamiltonian, and for that it is the BRS observables, they don't evolve. They just the extension evolves, just the exact term evolves. The yes, 5 minutes. Good. Then let me just come to, because I want this is not we and Hicke stressed in his talk, and I hoped my interjections made it clear that locally we have absolute equivalence with ADM. So locally at the classical level we cannot distinguish our theory from ADM. But now, if I can just use the usual effective field theory reasoning and close my eyes at two points and define a gravity theory space, which is just a local action for G and pi and the ghost extension that I have. This action should have ghost number zero, and it should be invariant under both kinds of transformations that I the SADM and the SD. And also, what you usually do in effective field theory, you restrict yourself to low-dimensional terms because you expect them to be important in the IR, because everything else is just by dimensional analysis suppressed in the infrared. And then you have a construction principle for modified gravity theories that are compatible with this construction principle. And now there are observable differences with GR, because in GR you have a construction principle that is based solely on general covariance. And in particular, if I use a four-dimensional language, I can write down I can include any curvature invariance of the four metric in my effective action a priori. Then Lee would immediately object, you get instabilities as soon as you include the Weyl tensor squared.
I wouldn't say that. There's a difference from GR. I would say there's a difference in the effective field theory going beyond generality.
Yes. I should have phrased it that way. You're correct.
And now you're saying they're not the BRS equivalent? From what you said, short here, it seems to me that the BRS equivalent.
No, GR and this formulation are equivalent. They are equivalent. But if I go and if I look at the entire theory space of effective field theories that are compatible with my symmetry principle, then I can have differences, because if you do what Donahue, for example, has been doing, he calculates what is generated at one loop, two loop, and he gets these counter terms that are there that are now, and they are curvature in the.
But these are controlled by the BRS cohomology of the original BRS operator. And it seems to me the complex that you're going to get here is going to have exactly the same cohomology. So have you computed the various cohomology of the second? Is it empty or non-empty?
That is something that we're struggling with right now. That is what we're struggling with right now. If there is something different, then we could really have observed. This is, yeah, you're exactly right. I have not stressed that enough. You're exactly right. You have to show that there is actually room for difference. It's not a priori clear that there is room for difference.
And we all know examples of similar constructions where you have this second operator, and then that has zero cohomology.
It could very well be. It could very well be. Then it would just do additional, but just could input additional constraints. Now, this is a very quick interjection on.
Sorry, let me understand this statement here. So is in layman's terms, do you want to require both GR symmetries and these conformal symmetries at the same time? Is that?
Yes. Yes, I want encoded in this particular way. Yes. Yes, this is what I want to do.
Because if you
shut your eyes and you don't look at the fact that this is, in fact, let me go to this slide here. If you shut the eyes to the fact that you have expectation values here in this Levinov-Taylor identities that you get from there.
Can I make a suggestion? We're now out of time. Can you finish the presentation?
Yes.
Because you're jumping ahead, you're answering a question by jumping ahead to the rest of your presentation.
There is one thing here. This can be said in one sentence. This is instead of what Enrique was presenting and what I suppose you were presenting, also is this bulk boundary duality. Is here we have this in the bulk. We have a duality between two descriptions of the same theory in the bulk. This is all I have to say about this slide. Let me now come to Niyesh's question. So if I shut my eyes and say these expectation values in some semi-classical regime are just the products of the classical field values, then I can say if I'm in that regime, then I have this construction principle that I alluded to over here. And that is, so if you impose that on the quantum theory, this is actually not what I want to do. I would much rather find a formulation, find a gravity action where some of these transformations are then linearly realized, so I can immediately conclude that these expectation values are the fields, the transformed fields. I haven't found that yet, and I don't even know if that exists, but I'm looking for that possibility. And because that would make predictions about counterterms feasible. The other thing is that you would immediately say is, why don't you look at the dual theory and use a different gauge fixing? And then maybe you can improve your power counting by choosing a different gauge fixing. This is something we haven't explored, but it's a natural question that you can ask. But then you run into the immediate problem. Then the observables of both theories are not the same anymore. This is something that I skipped over in the two in this one part. But then you have to use a dictionary between the observables of the two theories. So then you would take one theory as the definition of the other theory, but the operator that you calculate the expectation value for with this partition function has the interpretation of a different operator in the other theory. So let me come to the conclusions because I'm running out of time. So this entire formalism is very generic. But Enrique presented about the linking theory that you do an extension and you get two equivalent descriptions of the same theory that is very generic. It is also this construction here that I made is very generic for generally covariant theories. There is nothing special that happens with that. I'm just motivated by Julian's ideas, but the mathematics works very, very generally. So this is what I said. I was motivated by Julian's ideas, and this is why I chose this particular one. And then I just wanted to summarize these points that I just quickly made at the end. There could be different semi-classical predictions. There is also, now I do have a different theory space to do effective field theory with. So this is one of these things when you do exact renormalization group equations. The first thing, the starting point is you choose your field content and the symmetries you impose on that field content. And I have a different prescription there. And it's known that if you choose it differently, although classically they reduce down to the same phase space. You know that the quantum theories, they have different universality classes in general. You have different fixed point structures in, if you have different theory spaces. And I mean, this is that we have a different angle and looking at dualities in this formalism, just from this. And so in one line, I would say, I would summarize this talk, that there is a hidden invariance in the, that you can formulate gravity in such a way that there is a hidden invariance, which is due to Julian's ideas about local scale invariance. Okay.
Let's take 5 minutes for questions now because we have a discussion session later.
I'm curious, since you're proposing this as a serious first step towards the quantum theory and talk about quantum calculations, and if you impose seriously this spatial conformal symmetry as a gauge symmetry, it would have to be non-anomalous.
Yes. I wrote that up here. So
we have to know where it's written. I'm just curious. To believe that there is no anomaly generically in all systems.
Yes. Okay.
The conformal symmetry is always anomalous.
Yeah. So this is also related to one of your questions. We are trying to get a handle on the cohomology classes. The anomalies would live in the first and second cohomology class of this BS operator. So we're trying. I don't know why it's connecting now. It had plenty of time to do that before.
Okay, and so I think the answer is they don't know.
We don't know about the anomaly. It would appear on the right hand side. Yeah, of course.
Well, I know. I mean, that would of course disqualify this as a consistent quantum theory.
Yes. If that would appear, you're correct. I mean, you can still impose it classically because in the classical theory, right. But in the quantum theory, if that would appear, then we would have a problem.
I totally agree,
and I think in Toft's talk that you will talk about anomaly cancellation. This is what I read from the abstract. So we would have to have some mechanism like that to make this theory work then. But we don't. This is all in the future. Right now, I'm worried about writing research proposals.
Can you construct W supergravity?
We haven't done that. The three people behind you have been thinking. Not? I thought you were. Okay, then I'm wrong.
They constructed loop quantum supergravity, which is not the same thing, but it's pretty impressive. Okay, one more question? Anybody? Okay, Steph?
Yeah, this is intuitive. I'm just trying to get an intuitive graph. Maybe one doesn't exist. If we're to just say that there is, we would wave our hand and say there is some sort of duality, what are the degrees of freedom that are sort of mapped into each other in the simplest case that you would expect?
In the simplest case. In the simplest case, if I had two abelian sets of constraints, so what I always call chi alphas here, and they are abelian, and I had sigma betas, they are abelian, and their Poisson bracket, chi alpha, sigma beta, is strongly delta alpha beta. If I have this type of algebra for constraints all over phase space, and then you can locally choose adapted coordinates in phase space where these are just position, these are just some momenta, then you would have strong observables that just are independent of these positions and momenta, so they would not depend on the chi's and sigma, but on all the p's and q's that are in the complement. So that would be a complete set of observables. And those would be automatically commutative with both. So in that case, it would work. But as I emphasized, if you want to have a local description, you have to change. You have to change. So this would mean that you abelianize both at the same time. You can always abelianize one with this thing with this trick that I showed on the BIS slide, but the other one would still be non-abelian in general. In that case, you have to extend that with some exact function, and that is the relation between the two. So this is, I hope this answers your question.
Okay. Let's thank Tim.